And so what we have to try to do is deal with that. And what was interesting from my father's side is that even though he was a very conservative economist, very much a believer in the free market and so on, he appreciated that the government had to take actions to protect society when bad things happened. And in fact, he was very critical of some of the deregulations of economic institutions, markets that allowed hedge funds and derivative trading and things like this that basically brought on this crash. And although he was quite conservative, he felt the government should have been much more proactive. So is this, what do you do in the presence of uncertainty? And that was the common theme.
And what was it like actually working together on the book? Did you find yourselves arguing a lot? Or I guess each of you was writing, you were writing separate chapters and then you put it together. But you must have had a conception of how do we want this book to end, right? What are we trying to accomplish with it? So what was it like working together?
Well, there were a bunch of cultural differences. One of them is I had written a successful seismology textbook, and then I wrote a book for general audience about earthquakes. My father's writing was all sort of monographs for very high-level people, you know, in economics. And he didn't have this concept of explaining things to a general audience. For example, he hated teaching beginning economics at Brown, even though I suspect he probably did pretty well at it. But he just culturally didn't like sort of explaining things at this level. So he would go for these very shorthandy, very slangy sort of things. And I was very much explain this clearly, explain it well. So I gave him some of probably the best books in science about the for explaining things to people. The most famous ones being those by the physicist Richard Feynman, who was famous for his ability to explain complicated concepts. And I said that this is what we're striving for. I got him a bunch of other books and said, this is what we're shooting for. And when he wrote stuff that was too complicated, I would simply rewrite it and say, does this say what you want? And in general, I'd get it right, but we would iterate it. And he was pretty gracious about it. You know, the writing with another person is a pretty brutal and personal thing because you're saying, you're trying hard to say that's no good, but you are in fact saying that's no good. And I would rewrite parts of it. And he was getting into the spirit of it. It just wasn't in his cultural mindset. The other one that was different is that he never did media. He wasn't, you know, earthquake seismologists, for better or worse, are used to getting up on television or on the radio and explaining things after big earthquakes. We're used to, you know, we're used to PBS and NPR and, you know, you name it, you know. And he didn't have that. He'd always shied away from that side of economics. Okay, he'd always stayed very much on the math side, never wanted to get involved in that stuff. So I was trying to teach him a whole different style of writing. I mean, there were cultural differences in the way scientists and economists write, but the biggest was this very clear, and he said he really liked it. He'd never been forced into this discipline of explaining things, and he said he liked it.
I remember that, well, you also helped me with my writing, that when I was writing my senior thesis in college, you gave me a book by William Zinsser on writing well, a guide to writing nonfiction. And we talked a lot when I was writing it about how to always focus on clarity, and that's way more important than almost anything else. And then you said, tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. And I've always remembered that, and I thought it was great advice. And I love it that you were essentially giving the same advice to me back in the early 70s as you were giving to your own father. And it's great that you were able to help him in that way.
Yeah, I still use that book. I still give that book to students. I have, in fact, been in the last week working with colleagues at the Royal Observatory of Belgium in Brussels, where we have some ideas I'm trying to explain, and I keep trying to say we need to get rid of the details. We need to make this very simple and very clear. And You know, what is the point of what you're saying? You know, whereas the when we were talking in the 70s, I didn't know that word. Now with the students, I use the term elevator pitch. And the idea is, of course, in Silicon Valley, you know, you have a short elevator ride to pitch your concept to the venture capitalists. You know, so you have three or four sentences to get your idea across.
Yeah.
And my father was not used to that sort of writing.
There's another way. You were different, you and my dad. I remember asking you the same question before. Maybe it was 2 or 3 years ago I asked you this. I said, what's it like writing a book with our dad? And you looked at me and you said, well, the difference is his graphs don't have any numbers on them and mine do. And one, it cracked me up because it's very much our father working at this very elevated theoretical level, and the difference of practicality that, yeah, you can get the idea right, but if you don't, as a friend of mine said, without any data, your chatter don't matter.
And, ooh, that's good.
And I loved that. But I thought it was very interesting that the way he respected numbers, but he didn't always necessarily think in the first instance about them. And so I believe that's one of the ways that you guys worked so well together on that book. And I know he was so happy doing it, and he would talk about it all the time, and he took it very, very seriously. And and I think you'd agree that this is what kept him, writing that book kept him alive. Is that fair?
Oh, I think so. I think one of the terrible things that happens with older people is the tendency to sort of dismiss them.
Yeah.
And it's even worse when they're older and they're sick. Now, in our situation, I was dealing with a very bright person that I was intellectually engaged in who happened to be dying of cancer. But that wasn't the most important thing about him in our interactions. I think without that, you very much get a situation of, you know, well, people need to feel that they have a purpose. They need to feel they're doing something useful. They need to feel that you respect them and that they're challenged. And in some ways, in academia, we're probably better off than almost any other branch of society in that we do have a culture that values people's knowledge and experience. I think we all know that. And how you take advantage of that is very tricky, but I think we've learned. And I gave him several books when we started this project. One of them was a acquaintance, I won't say a friend. I would have liked it to be a friend, but one of the great geologists of the 1960s and 70s who was one of the discoverers of plate tectonics, the basic theory of geology that we use today. And he wrote a wonderful book while he was dying of cancer. And very, very thoughtful book about his life, his experiences, his view of how geology works and what makes geology special. And I mean, I saw him, you know, he came basically to give a talk about this when he was dying. Wow. And the other one I passed on, which I think some of you may have read, is this wonderful book called The Last Lecture by a famous computer scientist, Carnegie Mellon, who was dying very early, you know, very, very prematurely. Yeah,
that's a beautiful book.
Right. And and it was the same sort of spirit. He was trying to tell you, you know, how do I think about the world? He wasn't trying to teach you facts, but he was trying to teach you how to think about the world. How does a computer scientist think about the world? Bill Menard was the funny thing, the geologist thing. It was, how do I think about the world? And what I didn't know, okay, and I told my father afterwards, was that Richard Feynman ended his career by serving on the Challenger Commission that investigated the destruction of the space shuttle Challenger and completely reversed it. He was dying of cancer. He didn't want to go to Washington. And his wife said, you know, Dick, you must go because otherwise no one will tell the truth. And he went to Washington. There was a committee that was all basically supposed to say how great NASA was. Feynman said, no, terrible mistakes were made. They must be corrected, and here's what they are.
I remember you were talking about how Feynman was such a great teacher because he had the ability, he understood concepts so deeply that he could convey them simply. And I remember you told me this once about, everyone was so stunned by the Challenger disaster. And I remember you telling me how one of the key things that went wrong was the rubber O-rings between the different stages of the propelling the rockets that get sloughed off when the Challenger went into space, that the O-rings failed. And I remember first you told me this is a criticality one component, that failure of the component means failure of the mission and the death of everyone involved. And that Feynman had to persuade the people on the commission that this really was a serious problem. And so he had a glass of ice water and he put like a small sized O-ring in and it became all brittle and cracked. Do you remember this?
Oh, yes. Very vividly.
And I was trying to, you told me that story and I was picturing it. And I was thinking, that's a big difference between Feynman and I would say you as the kind of geophysicist you are, that going from the theoretical to the very, very real, that, okay, it's one thing to have an idea, but when you show this bunch of shirts or suits around the room, look, guys, this is what I'm talking about. This is what happens. And that's very, very important. And that's in many ways the essence of your book, is translating ideas into something very, very practical. Like, we don't want to say, oh, look how terrible this is, but this is how, as a society, you can make decisions that are going to affect everybody's life and may save people's lives, but also we have a way to make a rational decision about things. And I think it's that going from the idea to practice that is in many ways the most beautiful and strong intellectual outcome that makes your book so good, that you did that, you created that together. I don't know who had what idea, but it's your putting it together that way that makes it such a real contribution. And that, for my dad, that must have been, our dad, sorry, that must have been a really important thing. We all want to feel like our lives have some kind of meaning. And we always joke, like, do you want on your tombstone, he wrote lots of articles, or do you want on your tombstone that you made a difference in people's lives? And you guys, I think you guys did that in a completely unique way. And it's something that is very, I think it's beautiful. I think it's very moving for me, and it makes me appreciate him in a way I couldn't have before. And it's something that it's always going to be in my memory about him. And I love what you said. You said something really important, that we almost dehumanize people when they're old and when they're ill. And you helped bring back his humanity. He was doing it anyway, as you said, but you really brought it to the forefront, and it made such a difference that it kept him alive. I'm convinced of it, he did. Well,
no, I agree with that. And one of the things that was important was that while he was dying at this age, there were some very, very neat insights in the book that were his. Okay, one of his very conceptual sort of arguments. And he said something which changed my life, and I think most people don't think about it. You know, when we prepare for disasters of one sort or another, hurricanes, floods, climate change, you name it, we spend all our time thinking about, what do we do? What's all the bad stuff that can happen? And my father had an economist point of view that I'd never heard, even though I'd been in this business for a long time. He said, look, we have to think about the harm of a disaster as the sum of two things: the money we spend preparing for the disaster and the consequences of the disaster. And we're looking for the balance between them. We're looking for them to make this is the outcome the least bad for society that we can, the sum of two things. And he drew this beautiful, completely conceptual curve that looked like a U.
With no numbers.
No numbers. None at all. Completely conceptual. Not at all the way a physical scientist would do it. He said, the bottom here, at one side, if we don't prepare for disaster, then we'll have high losses, but we don't spend our money preparing. At the other extreme, we spend so much money preparing for the disaster, we've spent more than the cost of the disaster. And somewhere in the middle is where we need to be. And I thought that was an incredibly insightful comment. I've given this talk a lot of times now, and most geologists or other natural hazards people have said, wow, that's a really good way to think about the problem. And he just sort of drew this. I didn't say drew it on the back of an envelope. I forgot what he drew it on. But
well,
it was a
great
really...
ideas are drawn right on the back of a cocktail napkin.
Cocktail napkin. But, you know, it was just him at his best. Really conceptual, really insightful, bringing some insights from economics to a very different branch of endeavor. And I think that this was what was really good, that there are a number of other places in the book that are like this. There's one idea that he threw out that at first I thought was kind of silly. And now we've got a lot of effort. My friends and I are working quite hard on this idea. Okay. And so, I mean, I think that this was really a good thing. And I think that to me, my big advice to anybody who has the opportunity to do so is, if you can connect intellectually with a person at this advanced stage in their lives, be it when they're in retirement or as they're getting older, try to connect with them in a way that values their contributions and recognize it. And, you know, a lot of times you can, obviously not always, but often, you know, people have insights, people have ideas that they can share with you. And you know, because we have like a retirement age and people are retired for a thing, and this is more your thing than mine, of course, we've artificially created a system which tends to discount the wisdom of older people. And we need to somehow figure out how to get that back. I think universities are a good start in that we have a formal recognition that people in that situation have a lot to tell us. And frankly, I've had similar relations, although nowhere near as intense, with a lot of other people that have retired that are really excellent scientists. Somehow we need to do that in the rest of our society. You know, that, you know, we shouldn't have like police officers retiring and going off and living in Florida. I mean, these guys have spent a career on the streets. They know a lot about the world. We have all these other jobs where people know a lot. And somehow we're not taking advantage of that expertise. You know, and I think as a society, we'd be a lot better off if we learned how to take advantage of it.
You know, I was going to ask you sort of as a final question, in what ways did the whole experience of our dad's illness and death, but especially writing the book with him, how did it change you? And it sounds like that's one of the big ways it's made you look at the world in a different way.
It made me more so, but fortunately I'd had a couple of retired colleagues that I would get a lot of insights from, and people that early in my career I was influenced by. You know, when I was 20, they were in their 50s, and now they're, you know, some of them have died and some of them are, you know, fairly senior. But, you know, you realize how sharp these people are. And, you know, you learn that, you know, your intellectual respect for people doesn't change because they're over 80 years old or something. You know, they know a lot. They have a tremendous amount to tell us. And again, this is more your thing than mine, but my understanding is that a lot of, we would say more primitive, whatever that world means, societies do a heck of a lot better job of using that information and knowledge and continuity. And, you know, we'd be a lot better off if we all learned how to do that.
I would say it's a difference between talking about people as elders as opposed to they're old.
Yeah, that's...
You know, old means used up. Elders means they have knowledge, they contribute to our society. We're glad they're here with us.
Yeah, I think that's really important, and I think we'd be a heck of a lot better off as a society, yeah, if we learned how to do that better. And I think universities probably do better than anybody else in our society. We sure don't do it perfectly, but at least we've learned, you know, we respect people, and we, you know, we're used to the idea that these people have things, yeah, to tell us.
Yeah. So do you have any final things you want to say about our dad and the experience of doing this with him, and anything that,
yeah,
you would say
I think,
is like the the capstone on
Yeah,
this?
I think my overall message would be that we sort of, it's really good for us to respect knowledge and understanding. You know, what our world today, our very fancy technological world, is built on thousands of years of accumulated information. You know, and we need to, that's part of our process. That's part of what makes we are. And we want to celebrate that. We want to recognize people's contributions. You know, things didn't start yesterday and they didn't start 20 years ago. And if we don't recognize that, you know, we hurt ourselves and we're cutting ourselves off from a lot of our history, from a lot of our development as people. So both as individuals one-to-one, but also as a more general sort of thing as to how our world grows, how we advance.
I completely agree with that idea. And the only little tweak I would add to it is we're really good at accumulating information and we're really bad at digesting that into knowledge. And that's where we want to do. And that knowledge is ultimately, that's what humanizes us.
Yeah, I would have said it slightly differently. In fact, I thought you were going to say exactly what you said, that we do a really good job of preserving knowledge and we're much less good at preserving wisdom. And what...
Well, I meant by knowledge,
yeah,
I meant...
Yeah, I was going to use wisdom in that regard. I was going to use knowledge as facts and wisdom as a softer but equally real sort of thing of... an understanding, a conceptualization of how the world works. And I think every one of us, when we talk to older people, and it really doesn't matter in what walk of life it is, or where in the world we are, or what culture we're in, know, as you said wonderfully, that these elders have a tremendous amount to teach us. And if we should gain from them, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because we are the better and the richer for taking advantage of what these people have to tell us. And some, you know, we should learn from, I don't know, Indians or other cultures that have learned to do this.
You're right. That's beautifully said. Thank you, Seth.
Thank you, Gil.